You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
So I'm Bruce Katz. I'm vice president at Brookings, and with Amy Liu, I'm the co-director of the Metropolitan Policy Program. I want to say welcome to everyone in the audience, to everyone watching by the webcast. So before I turn it over to Bill Fry, who's the real star of the show today, I just want to take a moment and place this important book, Diversity Explosion, #DiversityExplosion, in the context of metropolitan areas and metropolitan policy. So here at Brookings Metro, our goal is to help city and metropolitan leaders and give them the data, the tools, the strategies they need to build more prosperous, more inclusive cities and metropolitan areas in the face of hugely disruptive dynamics. Those dynamics obviously include, from a good portion of our other work, the massive economic restructuring underway in the United States, which despite continued job growth remains a struggle for many cities and many people around this country. We also take a look at climate change and the disruption which is occurring really at the street level, whether it's devastating droughts to punishing hurricanes and floods, that cities need to commit to building communities that are resilient and sustainable. Today we're going to talk about how cities and metropolitan areas are on the front lines of demographic transformation, which is the simultaneous aging and diversification of our population that will bring a host of challenges and, frankly, a host of opportunities. From building cities that allow the baby boom generation to comfortably age in place, to ensuring that we're providing an equitable education to the minority groups that are going to form the base of the next economy and our workforce. So it's this final dynamic that we're going to talk about. And without stealing too much of Bill's thunder, I'll just say that in this book, Diversity Explosion, you can buy a copy right outside, Bill has put together really the most clear-eyed assessment of both the scope of the demographic transformation as well as the litany of the impacts it's going to have transforming our economy, our society, and our politics, the rapid aging of our white population, the growth of new minorities, our shift to a no-majority nation. It's hard to understate the impact that these trends will have over the next half century, and frankly, they're already having in cities and metropolitan areas because these are the places that are on the front lines of this transformation. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Bill. He's going to present some key findings, and we're going to have a panel discussion with Bill, again, my co-director at Metro, Amy Liu, and the treat for today, Ron Brownstein, who is really the most knowledgeable journalist in this country who covers these demographic trends. Bill, just quick intro, he's been with Metro for over a decade. He is one, if not the leading demographers in the country. His insights and analysis are so sought after that I'd be surprised if he is not the most quoted scholar here at the Brookings Institution. Again, thanks to everyone for coming out this morning, and for those of you either here in the room or watching by webcast, tweet your questions to us, #DiversityExplosion. Amy will take a look at that, and then we'll try to answer them as we go. Bill Fry.
Bruce, thank you very much. Before I start, I first want to thank the Metropolitan Policy Program and all the people there for all the help they've given me in putting this book together. And I also want to thank the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research, with help from Brookings, was able to help me really in great ways with this book. And I also want to thank all of you for being here today. You know, it takes a little bit of extra effort to come and hear someone talk about their book on demography. They always say demographers are people who really aspire to be accountants, but lack the personality. So in talking about this book today, I'm going to try to enliven it a little bit, but I do think this is a very important demographic time for us as a country. After I've looked at the results of the 2010 census, of the projections that come out from the Census Bureau, the results of the 2012 presidential election, it became very clear to me that we're in a very key transformative period with respect to racial change in the United States. And I titled the book Diversity Explosion just to give a little bit of emphasis to all of this. I'm not trying to scare anybody because I don't think we need to be scared. I think it's actually something that's going to help us as a country over the next decade and decades to come. But I wanted people to understand that this diversity boom that we're now experiencing in the United States will be every bit as important in the first half of the 21st century that the baby boom was in the second half of the 20th century. It's going to affect us in all kinds of ways. I mean, I am a baby boomer. I'm one of the older baby boomers around. And, you know, our generation, we're the Woodstock generation. We changed the way families were formed. We changed women's roles in society. And, you know, now a lot of us are moving toward the older ages. And that's gone. Now we're talking about a new boom in the United States that when we get to the year 2050, people are going to look back at this period and call it the pivotal period of demographic change in the United States. And I think all these census and election results and so forth show us that. So I have a graph here. The book has lots of nice charts and maps, if you like charts and maps. And this is the white and the minority population from 1970 projected up to 2050. And you can see the gray bar is the white population. The orange bar is the minority population. And we were pretty much a white society for, you know, several decades before we are sitting here now. But when we get up to 2040, between 2040 and 2050, the Census Bureau says 2044 is the year we're going to have more minorities in the United States than whites. And I think this is something that some people realize, but they're not really absorbing. I want to talk about some of the major trends that are driving these shifts in the United States. First is the rapid growth of new minorities, and by new minorities I mean Hispanics, Asians, multiracial persons. These three groups will grow, they'll double their size in the next 40 years. And in fact, among them, they accounted for 3/4 of the population growth in the United States since 2000. Now, a lot of people immediately think, oh, we're going to have all this immigration, and that's why that's going to be happening. Well, it's why we've had some growth in the minorities in the last several decades. But going forward, most of the growth in the Hispanic population and the minorities in general will come from natural increase, the excess of births over deaths, rather than immigration. Immigration will contribute, but we already are in this mode where we're becoming more minority. And a lot of people will think, well, maybe that's because Hispanics have all these children. That's not true either. The reason that there is this growth, a natural increase for the Hispanic population, because it's a much younger population than the white population. And that's a good thing. Being a younger population, there are more women in their childbearing years. They have somewhat higher fertility than the other groups, but it's mostly because they're a young population. The second big trend is the slow growth and the aging of the white population. Now, this is something people don't really absorb right away, and it takes them a while to think about it. But in about 10 years, a little more than 10 years, we're going to have an absolute decline in the nation's white population, an absolute decline. So all the kids that are born right now are going to live their lives in a scenario where for most of their lives there's going to be decline in the white population and growth in these minority populations. And I always say it's important, especially important, that we have this minority growth because it's happening just in time to counter this decline in the white population, and it's going to help us in all kinds of ways, which I will portray. Now, it's not all about new minorities. The largest minority for a long time in the United States were African Americans. And while there's a long way for the African-American population to go to be able to be on equal par to the white population in many respects, they've done improvement in the last 40 or 50 years. And what's really important is the new population shifts that the African-American population are approaching, some of which it's the more well-off of the African-American population on the vanguard of these shifts. And I'll talk about those later, too. And lastly, we're moving towards a country where there's a no-racial minority population. It's nothing really to fear, but it's something to be prepared for. And we need to prepare for it because it's coming. And that's why I wrote this book, because I know a lot of people don't realize how imminent this is and how important it is and how many possibilities there are with it. And in order to understand that a little better, I think it's important to understand the demographic dynamics of this change. From one perspective is to look at the diversity by generation. We're becoming more diverse from the younger ages to the older ages, or from the bottom up, as we say. We're also becoming more diverse from the melting pot regions spreading out to the rest of the country. So I'm going to talk about the demographic change by generation from the bottom up. And here you see a chart which shows the racial composition of different ages, going from the younger ages at the top down to the older ages at the bottom. You can see that the younger ages are very diverse. The underage 5 population is about half minority and half majority. Down to the 85 and over populations, it's about 85% white. And when you look at this, you know, there are a couple reasons why this is occurring. I said the white population will start declining in about 10 years. But already we have a decline in the population that's under age 30, again, because of this aging of the white population. And we're lucky to have these new minorities filling in, so that we see, as we move forward, this younger population will increasingly become minority. In fact, by the year 2027, everyone under age 30 will be majority minority. Before 2020, everyone under age 18 will be majority minority, and we'll continue to move up that way. Now, one of the issues that have occurred as a result of this, and this is why I think people ought to read this book and understand this better, is we have something that I call a cultural generation gap. Now, the cultural generation gap is the inability, I think, to a lot of older baby boomers, and I'm an older baby boomer, and I don't characterize myself this way necessarily, but a lot of older baby boomers to not look at this new minority as in a helpful light or in a good light. In 2011, the Pew Hispanic Center did a poll and found that among white baby boomers and white seniors, more than half thought the growing numbers of newcomers from other countries were a threat to traditional American values, a threat to traditional American customs. And I think that's something that's difficult. And you can somewhat explain it by the fact that when you look at this younger population, they're so diverse. They're doing multiracial dating, multiracial marriages. It's a much more open among these different groups. The older population, people that were born when I was born, grew up in the 1950s and 1960s when we hardly had any immigration from outside of the United States. The only minorities in the United States we had back then were African Americans and lived in very segregated and discriminated parts of the country, didn't have a lot of interaction from the mainstream part of the population. So there's a little reason for all of this, but it also spills over into politics, something that Ron Brownstein, I'm sure, is going to talk about later, where he talks about the gray and the brown and their different voting patterns. And one thing that's symbolic of that is when a survey question is given to younger people and older people are, would you like more government services? Would you like a bigger government, even if it took more taxes? The older population says no. The younger population says, yeah, we need more of that. We need more for our schools. We need more for our health care. We need more for young adults to be able to take care of their kids. And so that cultural generation gap takes over into politics. And I think all you have to do is look at the results of the midterm election to see where the different groups had gone. And of course, the older white population was much more energized in voting toward candidates were for this smaller government kind of message. There is, however, a kind of a reason, somewhat rational reason, why Hispanics and whites take different views of how much support should be given to kids versus how much support should be given to older adults. Demographers have something called a dependency rate. You can look at the number of people who are not in the labor force ages compared to the people who are dependents, either children or seniors. You can have a separate young dependency rate or youth dependency rate and a separate old age dependency rate. Now, if you look at Hispanics, and this is projected from 2010 up to 2040, that blue line shows the size of the youth dependency rate, how many of the people in the labor force are going to have to be worried about their kids to support. And it's much higher than the senior dependency rate or the old age dependency rate, which is the orange line there. Whites, on the other hand, which has a much older population, before 2020, the senior dependency rate, the old age dependency rate, is going to eclipse the child dependency rate. So you can see there's a reason, perhaps, why older people are worried about themselves when they get old and their parents when they get old, and younger people are more worried about their kids. But another way to look at it, really, is that if these older folks want to have a Social Security system that is still flush, and if the Medicare system should be still flush, then we need to have people in the labor force who are productive, who are entering in the middle class, who are contributing to those taxes, and that means more investment in these younger people, into things like formal education, English language training, removing barriers to post-secondary education, and all that sort of thing. And so I think that's really where we need to be headed, and I think, you know, sooner or later, again, as more people read this book, they're going to understand that this is going to be important. Now I'd like to talk about the other demographic dynamic, which is diversity from the melting pot out. If you look at this schematic picture of the United States, I've indicated in blue what I call melting pot states. And these are states with big immigrant magnet areas like Los Angeles, New York, Miami, and Texas metropolitan areas. These are places where Asian and Hispanic immigrants, when they first started coming in the 1980s and in the early 1990s, more or less stayed there and stayed put. And the reason is they had a lot of social support from enclaves that were already there, people who helped them get jobs, people who helped them, you know, just sort of acclimate themselves to the American way of life. And at the same time during that period, a lot of the white population and the middle class population was moving somewhere else. They were moving to the southeastern states, which were very robust economically, and a good part of the Mountain West. Those are the orange states, which I call the new Sunbelt states. Now, I was looking at this at that time, and I did a lot of analysis on migration in the early part of my career. And what I saw coming was kind of a balkanization in the United States. The balkanization being that in these melting pot states where the new minorities were tending to cluster, there's not a moving out, there's not an assimilating into the rest of the country as these other areas were attracting the people who were, some of them even leaving these places that were the melting pot states because of the high cost of living, among other reasons. And it looked like a bad scene in terms of integration of these new minorities in the United States. But as I looked at these numbers further through the late 90s, and especially in the last decade, there was a real dispersion of new minorities, not just their immigrants, but their second and third generation folks, out to the new Sunbelt states, and even to that yellow group of states, which I call the heartland. These are states that are not growing very rapidly at all. And as a result, you know, there's more integration going on. This is an economically driven migration. As these new Sunbelt states got to be more prosperous, they needed to people to work in both low-skilled and high-skilled jobs. And as a result, we had much more dispersion to these other places. Las Vegas, for example, in 1990 was 75% white, and in the 2010 census had it at 48% white. Now, Las Vegas was attracting people of all races and all backgrounds, but the huge growth of the minority populations, Hispanics and Asians, as well as African Americans, to Las Vegas changed the complexion of Las Vegas and lots of other parts of the Southeast, lots of other parts of the Mountain West made those kinds of changes too. Here's a chart or a map that looks at the different concentration and new destinations for Hispanics in the United States. Those green dots, those ones largely in the Southeast and the Midwest, are 145 metropolitan areas that I call new destination metropolitan areas. These are areas that are growing very rapidly in their Hispanic populations. And they're the places where the new dispersion is really at their peak. In some places, like Atlanta or Charlotte, they're sort of adding to other population gains there from whites and blacks and other groups across the country. But in places like Omaha or Scranton, Pennsylvania, they're coming in and they're the sole source of population gain. So this is really an important dispersion that people are going to need to get used to. The one issue, though, which I note in the book, is that the Hispanics that are moving to these new destinations are not quite as well along in the assimilation road as the ones in the concentrated areas. They have lower educations, they're more likely to be foreign-born, they're less likely to speak English very well. So that makes a real challenge and one that should be met by the people in these new destinations in order to make them successful. It's another part of the population shift, which I alluded to before, not the old minorities, not the new minorities, but the old minority, blacks. And this is a map which shows what parts, what counties in the United States have the greatest concentrations of different racial groups. And you can see the southeast, those red counties there, those are the places that have an overrepresentation of blacks. Well, of course, most people know there are a lot of blacks in the south. But what a lot of people don't know is that the black migration to the south from the north has picked up dramatically in the last 20 to 25 years. The 2010 census showed that in the 10 years between 2000 and 2010, there was an absolute loss of blacks in the states of New York, in Michigan, in Illinois, and in California, as this movement back to the South continued to rev up. And leading the way in the black movement back to the South are younger blacks, college graduate blacks, and retiree blacks. These are people, these are populations on the move, and they're helping to make these southern states black and white, pretty much. I did an analysis in the book that shows there's only three southern states where blacks are not the major minority population. And those are, of course, Florida and Texas and with their large Hispanic populations, and Oklahoma with a large American Indian population. But in most of the others, there's even three or more times as many blacks as there are Hispanics due to the existing black population, but also this new migration there. The state of Georgia, for example, half of their growth is due to African Americans. So I think that's a really important thing to look at. For example, if you look at the relative sizes of the black population in Chicago versus Atlanta between 1970 and 2010, the period of this black migration back to the South. Back in 1970, Chicago had almost, had well over a million blacks there in the left, the orange bar, Atlanta had less than a half a million, only about 400,000 blacks. But you fast forward up to the year 2010, and especially in the last two decades, big gains in Atlanta's population, and their black population now surpassed Chicago. Chicago used to be the main magnet for blacks during the olden days when there was that migration out of the South 100 years ago, 50 years ago. But now Atlanta is the big gainer, and it's just emblematic of this. So, you know, we talked about the dispersion of Hispanics, the dispersion of Asians, the new black growth to the South. There's a little of the book in the book about the white population, too, which is growing right now very tepidly, until about 10 years from now when it's going to start to decline. But what that means is when there are white migration shifts across the country, those places that are gaining whites means they're taking whites from somewhere else that aren't going to have a lot of fertility or immigration to replace them. As a result, about half of the 3,100 counties in the United States are actually showing declines in their white populations. Many of them are in the what I call the heartland, slow-growing parts of the country, but some of them are counties in big metropolitan areas like Los Angeles County or many of the counties in the New York metropolitan area. The white group population growth is tending to go to exurban places, tending to go to small metropolitan areas, but it's very, very scarce because there aren't that many whites to move around anymore given the older aging of the population and the fact that most people who do move tend to be younger. Okay, we've talked about the demographic dynamics. Now I'd like to see where this is all headed in terms of integration. You know, for a while in our history, we used to think there were certain stereotypes where people could live and couldn't live depending on their race, who people could marry or could not marry depending on their race, or who could run for public office and win depending on their race. And all of that has changed to some degree. First, I want to talk about melting pot cities, but more importantly, melting pot suburbs. This chart here shows for the different racial groups and different colors there, the percentage of metropolitan area residents that are living in the suburbs as compared to the city. And of course, whites have long beat everybody to the suburbs. Between 1990 and 2010, more than 70% of whites are living in the suburbs. But that has creeped up kind of slowly in the last decade or so. Where the real action is among the other minority groups, and especially in the last decade, the suburbanization of blacks. Now 51% of blacks live in the suburbs. For the first time, there are more blacks living in the suburbs than living in the city. Of the 10 cities with the largest black populations in the United States, 9 of them showed absolute losses of blacks between 2000 and 2010. And that includes not only Detroit and Chicago, but also Atlanta and Dallas. We saw that Dallas is gaining a lot of black migrants, but all of Atlanta's black population growth is in the suburbs. not in the city. And so this is a kind of what's going on. What also you can't see as vividly here is the biggest numeric growth in both the cities and the suburbs is now Hispanics. Hispanics will be probably the main contributor to growth in a lot of cities and suburbs as we move forward. Another look at the integration that's going on is reduced neighborhood segregation. And here's a chart which looks at the segregation levels over time between whites and blacks from 1930 up to 2010. Now, before I go through this chart, I want to make very clear, we are by no means looking anywhere close to the end of segregation in the United States. Segregation is very high between blacks and whites and has remained very high for a long time. But there is a pervasive and modest decline which is continuing to occur. For those of you who aren't familiar with this index, it's an index that shows if you look at the way blacks are distributed across neighborhoods and the way whites are distributed across neighborhoods, if they're all, each in separate neighborhoods, they don't intermingle at all, that index would be 100. If they were exactly distributed the same way, the index would be 0. So when you have a value of 60, which is a fairly high index for the segregation index, you can interpret that as 60% of the blacks in the whole metropolitan region would have to move somewhere else to be distributed the same way that whites are distributed. So that you can see up till about 1970, the black segregation in the United States was very, very high. This was a very unfortunate period in America's history. The period of redlining, exclusionary zoning, all kinds of nasty things were going on, which I write about in that chapter in the book. But since 1970, there's been this, I said, a modest decline, in the sense that we still have an average segregation level of somewhere around 40 or 50 in most metropolitan areas in the United States. But it's going down, and where it's going down the most tends to be in the growing parts of the country, places like Atlanta or Dallas that are gaining not only blacks from the new migration, black migration to the South, but also gaining other racial and ethnic groups. When you have that mix of racial and ethnic groups, it's not so much as the us versus them that we had many decades ago. So it's something we still have to deal with and pay a lot of attention to, but it's moving in the right direction. The next one I want to look at in terms of trends towards integration is more multiracial marriage and identity. And this is something that really is going to bubble up over the next several decades in the United States. If we look at multiracial marriages as a percent of all marriages, back in 1960, it was less than 1%, actually less than 0.5% of all marriages were multiracial marriages. Now, among new marriages, it's 15%, one-seventh of all new marriages, which is made up a lot of young people, are multiracial marriages. One out of four new marriages among Hispanics and one out of four new marriages among Asians are multiracial marriages. And in fact, one out of eight total marriages among blacks are white and black marriages. Back in 1967, a white-black marriage would have been illegal in 16 states. But now we see that there's more diversity, and as a result of this, we're having more multiracial children in the United States. So let me just look at one more of these trends towards integration, and this is extending the political battleground, the topic a lot of people are interested in. You know, I think it could be said very fairly certainly that Barack Obama can credit the minority population for winning his presidency both terms, especially in 2012. George Romney got one of the biggest white Republican margins that has been held by any Republican candidate, actually the biggest one since 1984 during the Romney-Mondale examination, and he still lost. And the reason he still lost is because he had very solid support from the minority population, a population that has become an increasing part of the eligible voter population. So it's the demography that's changed. It's the turnout that was bigger for Obama among the people who were able to vote. And, of course, the voting preference, the actual vote, was very strong. Now, will that continue? Well, we don't know if the next Democrat will still get the same kind of support that Obama would get among the minority population, but it's likely that they're going to be a much bigger player than minorities have ever been before, and Republicans are going to have to sort of deal with that. But I want to talk about the geography of all of this, We know that minorities, even today, don't use their full population clout when it comes to the voting booth. Hispanics, many of them are too young to vote, and when they start getting those voting, getting into their voting ages, they're going to increase increase the number of Hispanic voters. And both Hispanics and Asians don't have turnout rates, even though they had high turnout rates in 2012, near where they could be. They're still much lower than white turnout rates. So there's a great deal of minority potential that has not yet shown up. Even so, when you look at the minorities as a share of all eligible voters in 2012, you see that there's a whole slew of states where minorities are 35% or over of the eligible voter population, many of them in the Southeast, places like Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and so forth. The Southwest as well as the Southeast. So this increases the voting clout. But where it really has happened, where they've shown their stuff, was in Obama's election. Let's go back to 2004. Where George Bush won the election. Those red states, of course, are Republican states, states that George Bush took. And the blue states were the Democratic states. And this is kind of the breakdown we would have seen in the United States for almost any Republican win going back to, you know, the 80s. The Republicans took these fast-growing Sunbelt states as well as a good part of the middle part of the country there, the Great Plains states, and you know this was their bailiwick. This is where they really shined. The Democrats held on to these coastal, minority urbanized states and a lot of the industrial Midwest. So this is the classic game plan. But when we get into 2008, notice that those blue states shift down to the South and into the Mountain West. Those very states that are getting lots of new minorities. And the other thing to notice here is that I have two colors of blue there, two shades of blue. The dark blue states are the ones where both minorities and whites voted for Obama. But the light blue states are the ones where only minorities voted for Obama. And their clout was big enough to counter the white minority, the white Republican vote. So in states like North Carolina or Virginia or Nevada, it really was the minorities that were important for Obama. And it reflects the fact that we have this diversity moving to the new Sun Belt. Now we move to 2012, and it's a similar picture to 28. We don't have North Carolina in the picture that year, but we have most of the others. But the other thing to notice here is that in 2012, a lot of those northern states, a lot of those Midwest states, are won because of minorities. They're light blue rather than dark blue. And I would say that, you know, this could be good news for the Democrats in the future, but it may not be, because many of these older states in the Midwest and the Northeast are having those baby boomers move into those older ages, and they're going to be turning out to vote in large numbers. It could be that if the Republican old white share increases a little bit, that may counter the much smaller minority shares of the votes in those northern states. But at the same time, the Democrats are making inroads to the South. So the cultural generation gap that we saw nationally may play out geographically, and that the South, as it grows more rapidly with these new minorities, may take more Democrat support, and some of the older, whiter states may take more Republican support. But as I always say, it's really the politicians are the best demographers, and they're going to see this very clearly, I think, when we come along in the next election. So I want to sort of stand back after looking at all this stuff. What we've looked at is this diversity explosion, this big demographic shift in the United States. We've seen how it plays out in terms of from the bottom up of the age distribution, from the melting pot in terms of the dispersion of minorities. And we've seen how the population is becoming a little more integrated. But in other parts of the book, I show there's still very large gaps between whites and blacks, whites and Hispanics, on measures of education, poverty, and income. We know that since the recession, the wealth gap between blacks and whites has increased substantially. We know that unemployment has increased dramatically among minorities especially. And we also know that there's these flashpoints like Ferguson and in Staten Island a couple weeks ago, which show that just under the surface, there's still these kind of racial animosities that are going on. And so the issue is, you know, where are we going given this very big demographic shift that the country is going to undertake? I think using this book, we can find ways to help alleviate future problems. One is because we're moving from the bottom up of the age structure, that we need to pay huge attention to the next generations of minorities in the United States. This means making a lot of effort in terms of making sure they get the right kind of education, that they get the right kind of pathway to the middle class, the right kind of job training, and the right kind of both federal and local support to help the families of these young minority folks. I mean, this is a priority. It's not just something that, you know, off somewhere, that's happening somewhere. This is going to be soon all over the United States. And we really need to pay huge attention to this. The second is that we need to pay attention to new destinations for these minorities. The way we can avoid a Ferguson 5 years from now, 10 years from now, where new minorities are moving to places, be they suburbs or small towns, that there weren't minorities before, is to be proactive about this, knowing that this is happening demographically. Unless we do this, we're going to be asking for trouble. But we can plan for this. We know it's happening. And so I think we need to pay a lot of attention to it. Third, I think we need to do something to close the cultural generation gap in the United States. This kind of idea where older whites vote one way, which seemed to be not for the kinds of resources we need to help the younger generation along, and the younger minorities and also younger whites vote another way. I think that's something that needs to be made apparent to people and understand the consequences of it. And I think that takes national leadership, takes local community leadership, whether it be churches or local nonprofits and community groups, to stand up rather than use this as a wedge in politics to overcome that and make people understand the importance of all of this. So I think there are opportunities to do this. You know, and I'm optimistic that we can do this. First of all, I'm looking at these kinds of interracial marriages and interracial dating and declines in segregation that's going on. And I think that's important. It's especially important because it's the young people that are involved in this. When you looked at these demonstrations last weekend in New York and in Washington, D.C., who was out there? Young people, and not just minorities. They're the ones that want to stop these kinds of divisions that are going on in the United States. And I think that's a good sign. I also think that as a history in the United States, we're a melting pot country. It may have been for a period we didn't have a lot of immigration, but most of us have parents and grandparents who eventually who've told us over the years how their predecessors came to the United States and made their way. And I think that's something that's really in our DNA as a way. We also have the legacy of the civil rights movement. Even though we haven't gotten to where we want to with a lot of the initiatives of the civil rights movement, it's changed us a lot about the way we think about inclusiveness in the United States. I also think that the globalization of commerce and communication is going to be very important, especially for the younger generation, to be able to understand that people from different backgrounds have a lot to offer and to be able to communicate with them without any kind of bias or without any kind of prejudice. But the most important reason why I think that we're going to change in the future and be open to racial diversity is this sharp demographic transformation that we're going. When the civil rights laws were passed in the 1960s, only 15% of the population were racial minorities, and they were mostly blacks, and they were mostly living in segregated cities. When the 2020 census is taken, more than 40% of the population are going to be racial minorities. They're going to be voting. They're going to be running for office themselves. They're going to become established members of different industries and different communities. And I think when we get to that stage, there's so much that people are going to understand, not just in clusters somewhere else, but moving to all parts of the country, that they're going to understand that they have to take this seriously. At least I hope so. Thank you.
Very cool. We also want to welcome Ron Brownstein back to Brookings. I think many of you all are very familiar with Ron. Ron is a two-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the presidential elections. He's an editorial director over at The Atlantic, and he's a senior political analyst at CNN. And I'm really looking forward to digging deeper on the trends that Bill laid out. We're going to have an exciting conversation about these trends, about the economic and political implications of them. And, in fact, these two finish each other's sentences, so this will be a really natural conversation. So I'm going to start with Bill. And, you know, Bill had often said that one of the reasons that he wrote this book was that even though he'd been seeing these numbers for a long time, the 2010 census in particular really escalated the level of and scale of the change that's underway, which really pushed him to write this book. Now that you've been on the speaking circuit, can you say a little bit more about what's been the aha for your audiences? What's been stark for them from as a result of what you're, you know, what you've unveiled in this book?
Well, you know, I think the magnitude of all of this is new to a lot of people, even though it's the main message of the book. But of the magnitude, I think the idea that the white population is soon going to decline and that it's aging so rapidly, I think that's something that people don't really realize, and I think that's something they take to heart. Now, they may react different ways to it, you know, it's something people need to understand. The other thing is that, you know, there's a lot of discussion about immigration and immigration policy in the United States, which is very important, and I have a lot of opinions about that, but they're not what I wrote about in the book, because I think the main message here is that irrespective of what our immigration is going to be in the future, and I think we are going to have immigration, it's just a matter of who it is and where they're coming from, that this diversity explosion is still going to occur because it's already embedded in our population. It's already embedded in our demography. So, you know, this immigration is kind of a false argument when it comes to how we're going to deal with the youth of our country. Immigrant integration, that's something we should be paying attention to, the children of immigrants who are already here. But the future immigration part of it is a different kind of discussion than the kind of stuff that I've been talking about in this book.
Right. Now, before I turn over to Ron, I did fail to mention that we are going to be able to go to questions from the audience and from all the viewers on the webcast. And in fact, we're going to take questions from folks from Twitter and the webcast. And the best way to do that is to ask your question via Twitter using hashtags diversity explosion, and we will try to pick up as many of those questions as possible. So keep those questions in mind as you listen to this conversation. So, Ron, Bill already mentioned the big elephant in the room, which is that this country, at least in recent weeks, have not really demonstrated its ability to adjust to this new reality. We've had Ferguson. We had a march this weekend in New York called Justice for All. We even have had stalemate on immigration legislation, including Senator Cruz really trying to stop spending on the president's executive order. Bill was just emphatic, as you can see in the closing of his remarks, that he is optimistic about the change in Senator Way. You said you were less sanguine.
Yes, I'm a little less optimistic.
First
of all, it is a double pleasure to be here because, you know, I've been writing about this, these trends and how they affect our political dynamics for about 25 years now, and there is literally no single individual I've learned more about the changing dynamics of America from than Bill Frye. And I'd also say there's no single institution that I learned more about how America is changing from the bottom up in the Metropolitan Studies program. So it's really great to be here on both those fronts. And in all the statistics that you gave, there's one other that you did not give that I think that really underscores the urgency of this conversation because, you know, this fall is a true tipping point in American history. This is the first school year ever, the one that began in September, where a majority of our K-12 public school system nationwide, not just Dallas and Miami and LA where I now live, but nationwide, a majority of our K-12 public school system is non-white. And, you know, last June was the last time ever in American history that a majority of the K-12 public school system was white. You know, something that had been true through all of American history. But I think our politics are challenged by this. You know, Bill, you know, my version of Bill's great insight about the cultural generation gap has been to talk about the brown and the gray, and that we are living through two demographic revolutions simultaneously, diversifying primarily in our youth population, at least at the forward edge, and then aging in a baby boom that is 80% white, and is that number goes down very slowly over time. I completely agree with the underlying conclusion that there is more common interest between these two generations than our politics allows, because ultimately, to support the retirement safety net that the baby boom needs, we have to do a better job at moving more of this future workforce into the middle class. But that's not where our politics is today. Our politics today is that we are living through an overlapping generational, racial, and geographic realignment that is leaving us with two coalitions that are utterly divergent in who they represent, where they live, and what they want. I've described our coalitions essentially today as separate but equal coalitions. I mean, the reality is that no Democratic presidential candidate since Lyndon Johnson has won a majority of whites. Since 1988, the total variation in the Democratic share among white voters has been between 38% and 44%, according to the exit polls. Barack Obama lost whites, became in 2008 the first candidate ever to lose whites by double digits and win. In 2012, as Bill alluded to, he lost whites by 20 points. Mitt Romney won a higher share of the white vote than Ronald Reagan did in 1980. And he lost by 5 million votes. And he lost, of course, because the minority share of the vote is doubled, essentially double from when Bill Clinton was first elected. And every Democratic nominee since 1976 has won between 78 and 82% of the combined minority vote. This translates down into Congress. Four-fifths of the House Republicans today represent districts that are more white than the national average. Two-thirds of the remaining Democrats represent districts that are more non-white than the national average. There are exceptions. Democrats still are competitive with white voters, particularly in the upper Midwest, where there's kind of that populist kind of, you know, who's on your side tradition. We saw that in places like Ohio. But the reality is that there were only four Senate races of the 22 with exit polls in this year where Democrats ran even among white voters. So today, I think our challenge is that, I wrote a book several years ago called The Second Civil War, which is an attempt to explain how we've become so polarized. And, you know, it's an almost a metaphysical question whether we are more divided than we used to be, whether there are greater divisions in our society today than there were in, say, the 1960s, much less the 1860s. I think it's very hard to answer. What you can answer is that the political system now sorts out these divisions in a way in which makes them much tougher to resolve. Because what we essentially see is not only a partisan and ideological realignment, and I'll kind of stop on this point, but increasingly a racial component to that. You know, even in a country that is now 40% non-white, 90% of Mitt Romney's votes came from whites. 90% of the voters in the 2012 Republican primaries were white. Whereas President Obama now relied on minorities for over 40% of his total vote, and I don't think it's inconceivable we'll see a Democratic nominee in my lifetime get a majority of their vote from minorities. And the challenge, as you have these two coalitions that are literally separating, how do you find common cause between them? I think that's the big challenge for our politics for the next decades to come.
Well, one of the things I really find interesting about your brown and the gray is the policy collision that they're also heading towards beyond just the politics. And you talk about the entitlement versus investment. Can you say more about that
sure.
battle?
Sure. I mean, you know, and it's not, those are not the only irons in the fire. There are several dimensions to federal budgeting. But there's no question that, you know, part of the challenge we face is we have a growing senior population. The number of seniors are going to double over the next roughly 25 years. And that will demand more resources for entitlement programs. But you also have this enormous youth population that I think correctly feels, as Bill noted, that it needs investment in education and healthcare in particular. And finding ways to balance those two. You know, in 1969, if you look at the OMB figures, they classified one-third of the federal budget as investment in the future and one-third as transfer payments to individuals. Today, the transfer payments to individuals are over 60%, and the investment in the future is down to one-sixth. Now, when you add to that you know, this kind of racial overlay of like who are the principal beneficiaries. Look at the politics of the healthcare law. The healthcare law has been unique to me in my time in Washington because it's one of the only laws ever. Whatever else it did, it explicitly sought to transfer resources down the generational ladder. It slowed the growth of Medicare spending to fund increased coverage for the working age uninsured. Right? And that working age uninsured is a much more diverse population than those who are now in Medicare, which again are 80% white. You know, you saw the politics of that. I remember the Mitt Romney ad in 2012, you know, the which was showing all of these anxious white seniors. You were counting on that Medicare. President Obama is taking it away to fund a program. And the last three words of the ad were, "That's not for you." Those are the last three words. And, you know, the reality is older whites hate the Affordable Care Act, by and large. And so there is, this is not the only thing in play. There's obviously defense spending. There's obviously tax revenue. But there is a real tension between how much we're investing in the next, the productivity of the next generation versus how much we're spending to support, you know, kind of the needs of the retiring generation.
So let's take that need for investment in people and workforce and all that and talk about the economy and the middle class. You know, in the midst of this diversity boom is also a simultaneous concern now in Washington and in cities and states around the country that the economy is coming back, but a lot of workers are not gaining. We've seen increased income disparities. We're seeing racial disparities as well. Bill, again, give me a sense of why you feel that all of these trends will have a positive, eventually positive impact on employment and opportunity. And I wanted Ron to comment on, you know, given your look around the country, what, if anything, are the positive policies or programs coming up across the country that's trying to embrace this diversity explosion in a way that's going to prepare the next generation of workers?
Sure. Well, I think you have to separate different time periods and also different contexts. The time periods, this is probably the worst possible time to look at inequality between whites and minorities in the United States as a result of the recession and the very slow comeback for the reasons you mentioned. It's the jobless, to the extent there is a recovery, it's a jobless recovery, and the people getting the jobs are not the minority people when they're getting the jobs. So that's very important. The other issues you talk about is opportunity. I think opportunity will become linked with demography once all of the people, both in the Democratic side of the aisle, all the nonprofit groups, all the union groups, all of the people who are fighting very hard to have economic opportunity get to tell the rest of the population what the demographic situation is going to be, that they're not going to have their Social Security mm-hmm. unless they do something about these younger people. And so I think these demographic forces will give fuel to those arguments. It's not going to happen magically. You're not going to have a situation that's just because the demography is changing, things are going to get better. But it's going to give more fuel to those arguments, to those people who are trying very hard to make that opportunity possible. So I think that, and that includes people being elected to office with this larger number of minorities who are able to vote.
You know, by the way, if you have extra copies of this screen, you know, feel free to share because it's pretty amazing. But you know, despite your one chart showing the Hispanic growth, notwithstanding that, you know, I often feel like there essentially we're living through a period where you have one America that is part of this change and one that in which it is something happening on television, right? And in many ways, our politics follows that line. I mean, Barack Obama, as I said, won by 5 million votes. He won fewer than 700 counties. He won fewer counties in winning than Dukakis won in losing. He won fewer counties than any winner in the last 100 years. Okay, so there's a kind of an urban, culturally cosmopolitan, racially diverse America that's kind of voting one way, and an America that's sort of less directly affected, that is overwhelmingly voting the other way. If you look at the districts that are more white than the national average, as we're going to be reporting, Republicans now hold about 3/4 of them in the House. Right. If the white population is above the national average, 3/4 of those, and those tend to be places that are somewhat removed from the urban reality. But in terms of like what we can be optimistic about is, I think that the biggest thing that is a cause for optimism is the awareness in much of the civic and certainly business community that this is the future workforce. You know, that not only is the share of younger whites declining, but the absolute number. I mean, so that all of the net growth in the workforce anticipated through 2030 is non-white. In fact, it's more than 100%, right, Bill? It's like 120%. That's because the white number is actually going to go down not only by share. And so what that's producing kind of episodically and sporadically are programs that kind of address it. You're seeing cities not waiting for Washington and beginning to fund their own preschool, San Antonio, I think Seattle is one. The emergence of the hybrid high school post-secondary model to try to get more people over the hump. You know, things like PTEC in New York or the Alamo Academies in San Antonio, less developed but funded by the Affordable Care Act and this transfer of resources. Parenting programs, you know, trying to help young parents. You know, things like the projects that are underway on the word gap that Univision is doing with the Clinton Foundation. And others. I mean, you know, there are gains. I mean, we are seeing gains. I mean, the share of the entering college class that is non-white is, I think, double what it was 20 years ago. But as Anthony Carnevale at Georgetown has done this great work, that huge channel of new kind of talent is being directed toward the institutions with the least resources. If you look at the most selective institutions, the 468 colleges that are listed as the most selective, they are essentially as white as they were 20 years ago. And all of the growth is going to our community college and the least selective four-year public schools, which creates big challenges in terms of completion, in terms of life outcomes. So everything that helps you along that pathway, and even I would put down the states like Virginia is one of them, that are making it easier to transfer from two-year to four-year schools. Because understanding that the two-year school is where a lot of this future workforce is going to start because of their economic situation. But that continuum, really, right, from early childhood intervention to preschool to, you know, education all the way, the hybrid schools, to programs to help move more people from the two-year to the four-year schools. I think that is the area that I see the most reason for optimism, but there's a lot more that has to be done.
You know, a lot of the new minorities that Bill talks about, he talks about it coming from the bottom up. But I think some of the most interesting trends are the ones where it's from the inside out, the new destinations. And so I want to talk about the suburbs for a minute. And Bill, you had one slide about the increasing racial presence in the suburbs. But, you know, suburbs are not just the political battlegrounds. But they're now increasingly the place where a lot of the social and economic fortunes of America are being played out. And in fact, our program has done a lot of work about the rise in poverty in the suburbs. In fact, if you haven't read it, you should read Confronting Suburban Poverty. But Bill's book adds another dimension, which is beyond income, is racially who's there. And I think that I just wanted to flag two findings that add real texture to the fact that we no longer have these Ozzie and Harriet suburbs anymore. One is Bill's book said it's something new, which is the dramatic slowdown in white population gains in the suburbs. You know, and the second is there's a massive black flight from the central cities. In fact, from places like Detroit, Chicago, New Orleans, there's been a huge shift of the black population out of the central cities and increasingly into the suburbs. So I wanted to ask Bill first, tell us more about why these changes in the suburbs, and even, you know, maybe say more about what they mean about the improvements for African Americans in the U.S.
Sure. I mean, one of the biggest findings I found in poring over the 2010 census results, and you know, they come out a couple states every week, and you're there looking at the computer and trying to look at all this stuff. But in state after state, when I got to cities where it had black populations, those black populations declined and the suburb populations gained. Now, it's all not a rosy story because there are highly segregated suburbs just like there are highly segregated cities, and some of it just kind of spills over in the boundary. But when you look at the actual demographics of the people who are moving to the suburbs, they tend to be the more well-off of the African-American population in terms of educational attainment. They also tend to be more likely to be married couple families or married couple families with children rather than single-parent families. So it's kind of a selective movement in some ways, and it's more of the same in other ways. It's not an unadulterated good. It's not an unadulterated bad. But as the other studies we've done here at Brookings show, that the suburbs are becoming more like America in all kinds of ways. You know, increased poverty, more racial diversity, different kinds of family types, and so forth. But I think on the whole, it's a step up, and it shows greater opportunity for interaction with other racial groups, because it's not just African Americans are moving to the suburbs now. All the other racial groups are going there too. But I think on the whole, it's a good thing. But we do have to keep our eye in looking at those same problems in some suburbs that we've had to deal with in cities in the past.
Yeah, and Ron, I mean, Bill's slide basically said, not only, you know, we all know that the majority of Americans now live in the suburbs today, so some of this should not be a surprise, but every single ethnic racial group predominantly lives in the suburbs. What does that mean for the parties? What does it mean for elections? What does it mean for the issues that are emerging in the suburbs?
I think the issue of concentration versus dispersal of the minority population is really critical to the future of American politics. You know, when sometimes I say that American politics now can be summed up in one sentence. Republicans can't win enough non-whites to win the White House consistently, and Democrats can't win enough whites to win the House or the Senate consistently. I mean, the fact is Democrats have now won the popular vote in 5 out of 6 presidential elections, and that doesn't happen by accident. It doesn't happen because you have more charismatic candidates or technology. The only way that happens, as it did for Republicans from 68 to 88 when they won it 5 out of 6, is when blocks have aligned in a lasting way that provides an advantage to one side or the other. On the other hand, by 2020, the likelihood is by 2020, the Republicans will have held the House, what, for, you know, all but 4 years since 1994. And a big part of the reason for that is because this minority population, which has become absolutely essential to the Democratic coalition, remains very heavily concentrated in urban areas. And ultimately, I think, you know, to compete for the House, I mean, Democrats need 2 things. I mean, they need to improve among whites. You know, the reality is you can win 39% of whites and win the White House, but you cannot control the House, given population distribution with only 39% of whites, which is roughly where they have been for the last 3 cycles in the House races. So you need the minority population to disperse also. I think both of those things have to happen for Democrats to be in a position to consistently compete for the House. And the Senate is kind of like in between. The Senate is very much of a jump ball, I think, between the parties. But right now, you'd have to say, because of the demographic dynamics in particular, there is a kind of the possession arrow at the presidential level kind of points to the Democrats and it points to the Republicans at the House level until we see much further, I think, dispersal than we've seen so far.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting because you're basically saying the battleground, the suburbs, is really about a battleground for the House.
Yeah, well, yes. And, I mean, what's happened, I mean, politically, you know, the 2 things that have happened that took us from the world where Republicans won the popular vote 5 out of 6 from 68 to 88, the one where Democrats won the vote, is growing minority population and Democratic improvement in white-collar white suburbs outside the South, basically suburban whites who are culturally liberal, right? All across the country, places like that flipped in 92 and have stayed flipped. So that is an important part of the Democratic equation, but again, it is still concentrated in that metro area. And once you get outside of it, boy, it is red.
Yeah. So let me ask you about the black migration to the South. And Bill had a very compelling map there, where the states and the places with the largest black population was literally this big southern belt that stretched from Louisiana to Virginia.
Yeah.
But what's so interesting politically is that Senator Mary Landrieu just lost.
Everyone.
Yeah. And in fact, there's now no longer a statewide Senate Democrat in any of the Deep South. So how, explain to us this trend where there's a black migration to the South. You'd think that it would lean
right
a certain way, but yet there's not been a Democratic stronghold in that region.
Right. I think, as I said, the perfect segue from my previous answer. I mean, the two things that have created, the two keys to the modern Democratic coalition are the growing minority population and their ability to win more culturally liberal whites than they did in the 70s and 80s. Every Democratic nominee from, say, Adlai Stevenson through roughly Walter Mondale ran better among non-college than college whites, people who worked with their hands. But as we've seen since the 70s, this realignment of the white working class toward the Republican Party, over 60% of non-college whites routinely vote Republican now, what's allowed Democrats to prosper, despite that, in places like New Jersey and California and Illinois and increasingly Virginia, is they also, is they win socially liberal college whites. Okay, so since Gore, every Democratic presidential nominee has run better with college whites than non-college whites. What's relevant in the South is that this doesn't happen. Okay, so Democrats in the South run very poorly with non-college whites. They run very poorly with non-college whites everywhere. The difference is that elsewhere they can win 40 to 50% of the college whites because they're culturally liberal. But in the South, that has not happened. They're in the 20s still in Texas and Georgia. And that makes it really hard because the minority population, if you're counting on the minority population alone, you're going to wait a really long time. If you look at the states that flipped in the 90s, and then in this decade, it was Colorado, Virginia, and to some extent North Carolina, Nevada. It's both things have to happen. And in the South, the second one is not happening. You're not seeing the white-collar suburban whites become more receptive to Democrats.
So we're going to go to questions in about 5 minutes or 2 minutes. And I wanted to just bring Bill back into this conversation and bring geography back and talk a little bit about the battleground states as we go into 2016. Because a lot of the battleground states have either changed dramatically demographically, or they have remained predominantly white. So let's just, I want to just walk through some states, have Bill, because we ran through those maps so quickly in your presentation, just say a few, like, highlight of trends in each of these states. So let's talk about the Rust Belt battleground. Talk about Ohio, talk about Wisconsin, talk about Pennsylvania. What are the big demographic trends that we need to be, that the parties need to be mindful of that's happening there? And maybe Ron can comment on their implications.
Well, you know, I think about at least two of those states, is Ohio and Michigan. There's not a lot of demographic change going on there. You've got a lot of people getting older, a lot of white people getting older. There's some Hispanic gains. There's some at the margin. The major minority in those states is still African Americans, and they vote very strongly Democratic. And as Ron said, there are certain segments of the white population in those states are also from the old union days, and maybe some of the culturally liberal folks are still going to not vote as strongly Republican as they may have in the past. But what's also happening there is increased aging of the white population, and we know that old people, especially older whites, turn out very strongly in elections. And so that very thin, it's not that thin of a margin, but Ohio has been back and forth several times in the last several elections. That's up for grabs. Michigan, you know, it's at least possible. Pennsylvania is a little different because Pennsylvania is two states. Pennsylvania is the eastern part of the state, which is more like New Jersey, and the western part of the state, which is more like Ohio. And so I think the New Jersey part is winning.
Population-wise.
Population-wise, and in terms of diversity and the culturally liberal white voter and suburbanites and so forth, the suburban Philadelphia and so forth. So Pennsylvania was close last time, closer I think than a lot of people thought. But I think it's probably more trending Democratic. The other
real quick, yeah. So you have two sets of swing states now in presidential politics: the Rust Belt set and the Sun Belt set. As you noted, Amy, the Rust Belt is basically Michigan, Ohio, Iowa, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania to some extent, even though it's voted Democratic six straight. Maybe Minnesota at the far edge in Republican hopes, and they are the great anomaly. This is the part of the country where Democrats run better with the white working class than anywhere else. Not vastly better, but just better enough than they do in other parts of the country to be able to compete or hold on to them. And, you know, the question is how long can that, in a world where 60% nationwide, over 60% of whites over 45, over 60% of non-college whites nationwide are voting Republican consistently now in presidential elections, in good years and bad, how long can Democrats have that anomaly in the Rust Belt states? And that is key to their competitiveness.
Great.
To maintain it.
We're going to come back, if we have time, to the Sun Belt battlegrounds, but we're going to go ahead and open up for Q&A. And again, for those who are on the webcast or viewing from webcast, please send your questions via hashtag DiversityExplosion. And in all deference to the modern technology today, I'm going to take the first question from Twitter. And this question is actually one that I really wanted to ask as well, which is, this is probably more directed at Bill. What will multiracial marriages mean for the racial composition of the U.S. in 2050? I do think that it also challenges the way the Census Bureau is going to really categorize race in the future. Talk about the future of these categories, really?
Well, the short answer is nobody knows. I mean, this is a huge change in our population, dealing with people marrying people of other races, even within the Hispanic community, marrying different Hispanics of different nationalities. After all, most Hispanics in the United States didn't know they were Hispanics until they got to the United States. There were other nationalities that when they came here, oh, yeah, you're Hispanic, fill it out in the census. But so these categories are somewhat a little bit artificial, but it's also the case that the Census Bureau tries to keep up. And the bureaucracy, they try to make things going on. And I think by the 2020 census, we're going to see some change in the race-ethnic classification that actually treats Hispanics as if it were a race, although they may not actually say that. The only statistic I can tell you is that the median age of the United States population is 37. The median age of the multiracial population is 19. So that tells us something about where the future is going.
Great. Questions from the audience. I'm going to take these two right here. Why don't you ask both of your questions and we get in as many questions as possible.
I'm Fred Altman. I just have a quick question. How long is it going to be before the audiences at Brookings become...
Thank you. I'm Peter Gluck. I have a quick question probably for Ron Brownstein about Michigan in particular. In this past election, I believe it was the only state with an outgoing Democratic senator that elected a Democrat. And he ran against a woman, a Republican woman, who was quite popular. She served as Secretary of State. Do you have anything to say to make sense of that?
Well, she turned out to be kind of a weak candidate, had a lot of problems. And Michigan has been at the federal level. I mean, at the federal level has been leaning Democrat. It's part of what I've called the blue wall, the 18 states that Democrats have won in at least the past six consecutive elections, which is the most states they've ever won that often in the history of the party, 242 electoral college votes, many of them affected by the dynamics that we're discussing. Look, I mean, the basic dynamic at the federal level and the reason why you saw that wipeout is that the way states vote for Senate is lining up more precisely with the way they vote for president. There are 22 states that voted against Obama both times. Republicans now have 40 of their 44 Senate seats. That's not all coincidence. Those weren't all better candidates. 26 states voted for Obama both times. Democrats now have 41 of their 52 Senate seats. So that is the basic trend. The Senate races follow the presidential. The governors can operate more independently. They have a little more ability to kind of escape that undertow. But I think that goes a long way to explaining what happened in Michigan.
So for the webcast to know that we have more diverse folks in the Brookings room, there's a young Asian woman who had her hand up. You get the next question.
Hi, my name is Christine Zhang. I'm a research analyst in the Brookings Global Program. And my mom is here with me, and she has a question.
Thank you. Yes, I'm visiting here. So I have a question for your second slides about the trend for the immigration. My question is, given the current economic change in Latin American countries or Asian countries like China, the immigration may be changed in terms of the speed, or maybe the immigration to the United States, the demographics of the immigrants may be also different. So do you think that will change your slides, your second slides? Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, we never know from year to year or from decade to decade, you know, how the economic situation is going to be in Latin America or in the different Asian countries. But with the recession, we had a decline in the level of immigration from Latin American countries, especially Mexico, and we had an uptick in Asian immigration, especially from India. And as a result, even the new census projections that came out last week have a different projected growth in the Asian population than it does in the Hispanic population. The former now growing more rapidly than the Asian population, taking in these different immigration levels. So clearly economics has a lot to do with immigration. You know, in the past we had this immigration policy that was, and still is, very heavily associated with family reunification. But there's an increasing part of our immigration policy that deals with the economic pushes and pulls from other parts of the world, whether it be the actual immigration policy or the H-1B visas and those sorts of things. And irrespective of how we do our immigration policy, there'll still be this economic component to it. And it'll go back and forth depending on the rising and failing economy, how it goes in Latin America, and how things change in Asia. But right now, the Asian immigration is up, and it's projected to stay up.
There's one question I have from the Twitter that asked, what's the politics of the older minority population?
Not much different than the younger. I mean, it's interesting, you know, in a world where in the presidential, as I said, in every presidential race since 1976, Democrats have won between 78% and 82%. That's the total variation of the combined two-party, so separating out Perot, two-party minority vote. The cuts aren't nearly, college, non-college, male, female, younger, older, are not nearly as pronounced as they are among whites. I mean, there are at points Republicans have run slightly better. Bush is the one candidate, I should say. 2004 was the one time that was not true. Bush held Kerry to 71% among minorities with a serious outreach, right? I mean, he had a whole quiver of policies on immigration, on education, on faith-based charities. He tried to reach out, and there was some more, I believe, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, he did slightly better among older, I think. But the key there was actually, it was more religion. He did better with the evangelical Latinos.
Okay, more questions from the audience? Let's take two. Let's take the woman here and the gentleman. Yeah. Oh, why don't you take this too?
Good morning. My name is Elena Beverly. I'm with the University of Chicago. So thank you for your book and for the presentation this morning. I appreciated your commentary on the growth of minority presence in the suburbs. And we've also seen additional research from Brookings about the increased level of suburbanization of poverty. I'm wondering, we've talked a little bit about the implications for education policy. Do you have thoughts on the implications of these demographic shifts for fair housing policy?
Sure. I'll try at that. Fair housing is not my bailiwick, but I do know we need to continue to be vigilant about all of this. I know the auditing studies that were done by HUD, I guess it was last year, still show there's a lot of informal discrimination these kind of audit studies that show that that black couples and Hispanic couples are not shown the same kinds of places, not treating them the same and giving them the information. This happens just as well in the suburbs as it does in the cities. All I can say is we need to be vigilant. Just because people are in the suburbs doesn't mean that things are necessarily going
to
be better.
And in fact, often in the suburbs there's less infrastructure to deal with the kind of the need. You know, one again, in kind of the somewhat less optimistic camp, one statistic that really, I think, haunts me is this figure that we are now, as I said, this is the first year where a majority of our K-12 system is non-white. We're also we're approaching another tipping point, which is sort of less less reason for optimism, which is that almost a majority of the K-12 public school system attend schools in which a majority of their classmates are poor, qualify as low income. 3/4 of African American and 2/3 of Hispanic public school students attend schools in which a majority of the kids are classified as low income under the federal guidelines. So that kind of concentration of poverty, whether it's in urban areas or now increasingly in suburban areas, is just a huge hurdle for creating the inclusive economy that ultimately will provide the tax base to support all the aging baby boomers moving towards Social Security and Medicare.
My question quickly, can you talk about gerrymandering and how effective that will be in affecting elections in the future given the changing demographics of this country?
I'm interested in Bill's talk. I would just say real quickly that gerrymandering, I think, compounds the problem but doesn't create the problem. I mean, the problem is kind of the separation of where people are living, and I think that there is, even with similar demographic characteristics, a white family that will stay in a diverse urbanized area are different in many ways, in particularly their political orientation, than someone who will move 2 counties further out to get to a place that is more racially and religiously homogenous. And in fact, if you saw a Pew study earlier this year, found that among liberals put phrases like diversity as a high value in where they chose where to live, and homogeneity was more important to conservatives, both religious and racial. So gerrymandering makes it worse, But as my friend Bill Bishop, you know, his book, The Big Sort, it's real. I mean, there is a reality in terms of where people are living. And as politics divides more along cultural than economic lines, you know, the cultural values you express by where you live is really a good predictor of kind of political preferences. So I don't see gerrymandering as the core problem, although clearly it compounded the situation.
Take one question in the back, and then we're going to wrap up.
My name is Slavko Martinyuk, and I'm a retired sociologist. Thank you for an extremely informative presentation. However, what I heard are two contradictory messages. On the one hand, you say that the growth in diversity is reason for optimism. And on the other hand, I hear words like balkanization and polarization of society. I was wondering, you know, what is the basis for optimism is everywhere you look in the world, Africa, Europe, Asia, United States, diversity is nothing but a source of discord, friction, and endless trouble.
Well,
you know what? Let me take that question, because I was going to close with that sort of theme, which is I want to close with a sense of optimism. And I think, as Bruce said at the very beginning of this program, you know, we think it's fundamentally important for the nation to embrace the reality of this, the rising minorities, the shift to what I heard Bill, I think, calls the post-white America, because that is the future, and it's going to predict how well we will continue to prosper economically, stay globally competitive, and really ensure that incomes continue. We have to embrace this reality. I really appreciate, Bill, your book pushing people to not deny the trends that are just automatically happening. But how do we make sure that the findings of the book really create a fuel for progress, a move towards greater consensus, that as we diversify bottom up and out, that it's going to bring people together versus around solutions then divide?
Yeah. Well, I think we have a history of, I mean, the idea that diversity is always going to cause complexity. We just to look at the immigration to the United States 100 years ago, from Italy, from Poland, from Russia. Right now, you can't tell. Somebody may remember their great-grandmother was Italian, and that's important to them, but in fact, it doesn't affect their life very much, their life chances very much, their ability to get ahead in the United States, who their friends are, and so forth. That's happened because we have a history in this country of being a melting pot, because we have this kind of in our genes. So it's not the case that diversity always causes disparity, and I think that because of that, and more importantly this time, because we are going to have an aging and declining population unless we understand we embrace this diversity. And I think corporate leaders and political leaders, even if they don't read my book, are soon going to understand that this is going to happen. And when they do, I think people will become much more amenable to working together.
I would only add, I mean, I like the questioner. I see the potential. I think we are living through the politics of a lot of friction around these issues already. I think we see very stark overlapping racial and geographic divides in our politics that reflect, in many ways, anxiety about what's happening. The reason for optimism, I think, is that ultimately it is self-interest. You know, the debate about a more inclusive society, and particularly closing the gaps between whites and minorities, have historically been framed in terms of fairness. If we are the country we say we are, everybody should have an equal shot at being, you know, fulfilling their potential. But in many ways, the debate is moving, as you suggest, from fairness to competitiveness. I mean, this is us. This is the future workforce. And there is a self-interest, not only in the business community, but even in these older white population that is very resistant to investing in this next generation. Ultimately, they need that next generation to succeed. And, you know, as I said, our politics are nowhere near reflecting that today. But you've got to think that ultimately self-interest does count and that we can get to a better place. But like the questioner, I think there's going to be a lot of rubbing and chafing and banging between here and there.
So I'm going to close with that great line you gave us, which is Bill's book is really a reminder that this is us. So thank you for joining us this afternoon.